From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Big changes coming for public pensions. In a bankrupt Detroit where pensioners were thought to be protected, a federal judge ruled not so much. Bring on the cuts. Now Illinois is primed to slash retirement benefits as well, and they are not alone. Across the country, cities are insolvent with millions of retirees still depending on their pensions. This hour on Point, public finance and the nation's pension crisis. Listeners, you can join us. Is this a warning for the rest of the country? Are you counting on a public pension? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Tom Ashbrook is away today visiting member station KVCR in San Bernardino, California. He'll be back tomorrow. Today, we have an all-star panel of experts to talk about public pensions, what's coming and what is not. And we'll also hear from a retired Detroit police officer who is wary of what's ahead. First, from Chicago, though, with the latest is Tim Jones. He's a reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek. He's kept a close watch on the debate over pensions there in Illinois and further down the Rust Belt in Detroit. Tim Jones, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jane. How are you?
Well, I'm well. Tell us what things are going on in the heartland. It's been a big week there with regard to pensions and that federal ruling, of course. Let's start where you are in Chicago. What's happening in Illinois in the pension crisis?
This is all about promises, both in Detroit and Illinois. And in Illinois, there has been years, decades of financial mismanagement, basically broken promises that the state would put in the required money on an annual basis into the retirement funds. And they've realized the past several years that they've dug themselves into a huge hole. And to get themselves out, they felt they had to pass a bill that would cut cost of living allowances and make other changes in the pension system. And that would save the state over a 30-year period about $160 billion. And you can expect a very quick lawsuit from pensioners and from state employees saying this is a violation of the state constitution.
So is all this part of the legislation that was passed in Illinois, which approved essentially this $160 million of restructuring?
Yeah, that's part of it, the $160 billion in
restructuring. Right. Yes. And so when is that likely to take effect?
It is scheduled to take effect in June of next year. So in the meantime, the attorneys for labor unions and public employees are working on their lawsuit, and it will probably be filed, I would think, within 2 weeks.
And so what's the feeling there, Tim? Are people resigned to this? Is there anger? Is there acceptance? What's the sense?
It depends on who you talk to. There is anger. There is also alarm over the condition of the pension funds. They are saddled with $100 billion in unfunded liabilities. Increasingly, they are chewing up more and more of operational funding on the state level on an annual basis. It's taking money away from education and other essential state services. Mm-hmm. And Republicans and Democrats alike agree that this is an untenable situation, which is why they approved the bill last week.
Mm-hmm. So talk to us now about Detroit. Tell us about this federal ruling and how it ties into pensions.
I think the federal ruling in Detroit goes further because it answers one of the questions that is being raised in Illinois. And the federal judge there said that pension obligations do not have special status, and they're no more of a contractual obligation than anything else, which means that the city, in an effort to dig itself out of an $18 billion hole, can cut pensions, but it depends on how they do it. That remains to be seen. I think this is the issue going forward that is going to determine an awful lot about the future of pensions, not only in Illinois, but in cities and states across the country. Are these promises that were made years ago sacrosanct? Mm-hmm. And what happened last week suggests that they are not.
Let's hear from Judge Stephen Rhodes, U.S. bankruptcy judge for the Eastern District of Michigan. He ruled in favor of the city of Detroit's filing for Chapter 9 bankruptcy and made it clear that pension obligations are not untouchable. He called the filing a sad but hopeful sign for the city's future.
This once proud and prosperous city can't pay its debts. It's insolvent. It's eligible for bankruptcy. At the same time, it also has an opportunity for a fresh start.
And then last week, Detroit emergency manager Kevin Orr spoke with reporters following federal judge Stephen Rhodes' ruling that Detroit was eligible for this bankruptcy. Emergency manager Orr specifically addressed relieving pension burdens, saying the issue must be addressed.
Approximately 40% of every dollar that the city takes in the general fund goes to paying legacy debts, pension obligations, some of which are unfunded, or debt. That's just not sustainable because in the next 3 to 4 years, that number is going to go to almost 65%, almost two-thirds. We have to relieve the city of that burden.
Almost two-thirds there. Tim Jones, so the emergency manager, Kevin Orr, is essentially in charge now. What has he proposed? What does it look like he'll do?
Well, some of the details on that have yet to come down the pike. But I think you will see cuts in pensions. You will see sales of city assets. And as Orr said in that clip, this is a chance to start over. But in starting over, some people are going to get hurt.
Tim Jones, reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek. Tim, thank you very much for your time and information.
Thank you.
And leaving Chicago now, let's go to Detroit. Joining me now, John Day. He is a retired Detroit police officer, worked as a police officer for 26 years there, made detective. Now he gets a pension every month. John Day, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jay.
So when you heard the ruling come down last week from the federal judge, what were your thoughts?
Well, I thought it was one man's decision. And, you know, it's now in the appeals court. We'll see what happens there.
What is your pension, John? Do you mind telling us what your pension benefits are in retirement?
My pension benefit is approximately $2,900 a month.
And do you use that to live on? Is that an excess of savings,
yeah, of
or
course,
what is it?
Of
yep.
course. I mean, I supplement income from my part-time job, money that I've saved.
And just to be clear, John, you don't receive Social Security, correct? No Medicaid. Your pension is it.
The police and fire pension, which is what I'm part of, we're not eligible for Social Security, mm-hmm. and we're not eligible for Medicare. So by the emergency manager, or by the governor, I should say, by the governor stripping our health care and then wanting to cut our pension, he's actually going to bankrupt thousands of people.
What about those voices, John, that say, you know, like it or not, the city is insolvent. Pensions were too large for too long. They were mismanaged. They just need to be cut. There's no other choice. What is your response to that?
I think they're grossly inflating their legacy liability. I mean, Bond Buyer publication put out an article on this. They basically cut the way that the formulas worked for pensions. They've taken an assumed rate of return from 8%, which is pretty much standard across the country. Now it may be a little high, but taken it down to 6.5%. And instead of amortizing it over 30 years, they're doing it over 15, which makes them look grossly underfunded. But even with that, the police and fire pension in Detroit is at 80% funded using his own numbers. Using the earlier numbers, we're at 96% funded. So they took it from $143 million underfunding to $1.4 billion. So the numbers, you know, it's an accounting gimmick, because basically the entire plan from the governor, I believe, was to shed the city of all their liabilities.
So what do you want to see from your government, from the city of Detroit?
Well, I want to see the city honor their promises. You know, I want the governor of the state to honor the Constitution of the state. I mean, his own attorney general filed in federal court to defend the Constitution of the state when the governor, all he had to do was exempt the pensions from the bankruptcy. We always compare Detroit's pension liability with other grossly unfunded pensions across the nation, and it's not the case.
So what's the lesson here, John, for union leadership, for other cities across the country who may be facing these very difficult choices, real-life circumstances, people like you?
Well, you know, I think, really, you know, I would have much rather You know, every time we negotiated a contract, by the way, you know, this vilification of public employees that somehow we're in collusion with the politicians to pump up these pensions, it couldn't be more false in the situation in Detroit. I didn't have one contract negotiated in my entire career. They were all arbitrated by the state. So what I would suggest, you know, instead of, you know, because they would always use the pensions in lieu of salary. Mm. So the way I view it is deferred compensation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would have much rather had the salary and saved on my own than being put in this pension system. But I didn't have a choice, nor did any of the other men and women of the police department and the fire department. So
John,
you know, I would suggest that they negotiate for higher salaries. You know, maybe be included in the Social Security and Medicare system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but the city doesn't want that because that's an added cost to the city.
John Day, retired Detroit police officer of 26 years. I know a lot's on the line for you here, John. Thank you very much for speaking with us. Good luck.
Thank you.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about public pensions this hour, Under the Knife. Joining me in the studio this hour is Alicia Monell, director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, professor of management sciences at their Carroll School of Management, former member of the President's Council of Economic Advisors and assistant secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy under President Bill Clinton. She's author of State and Local Pensions, What Now, among other books. Alicia Monell, welcome back to On Point.
Delighted to be here, Jane.
Also in Klamath Falls, Oregon, Andrew Biggs joins us, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies state and local government pensions. And in 2005, under President George W. Bush, he worked on Social Security reform as an associate director of the White House National Economic Council. In 2001, he joined the staff of the President's Commission to Strengthen Social Security. Andrew Biggs, welcome to On Point as well.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
So, Alicia, let's start with you. We'll get to solutions later this hour, but help us understand better the problem. Detroit is said to have $8 billion of unfunded pension obligations. Is this an issue of mismanagement? Is it something worse? How did Detroit get to this point?
Jane, can I take a step backwards? Because we're looking at basket cases. Detroit just has horrendous financial problems. And Illinois politicians are just deadbeats. They have never paid not only their pension bills, but a lot of other bills. So we're looking at the worst city and the worst state in the country. And then there's this tendency to generalize that we're going to see, you know, a landslide of bankruptcies across the country, that mm-hmm. we're going to see huge pension cuts backs. I think we just need to be careful about generalizing.
So it's not as bad as it seems? Just in these particular spots, it's horrific?
These particular spots are horrific. But if you look across the country, there's some pension plans that are perfectly well-run and well-funded. And these are the worst. And it's horrible situations. And I can understand why everybody's mad and frustrated. But I thought you're retired police officer had, John Day, had a really important point. We ought to also remember what we're trying to do here. Pensions are not just a football that we cut or expand or cut or expand. We're trying to hire good people to run our cities, to run our states, to teach our children, to protect ourselves from fire and crime. And we should pay a reasonable compensation package, or else we're not going to get good people. And we talk about a lot of cuts in pensions, but we don't think of in terms of total compensation, which is really important.
So, Andrew Biggs, do you agree with that pensions are a way to pay good people in tough jobs?
Oh, sure. I mean, the pension is part of the total compensation that the public employees make. In general, state and local workers receive salaries that are a little bit below what they would likely receive in the private sector. And the idea is that pensions, retiree health care, other aspects of the job will make up for it. You spoke to John Day, the retired police officer from Detroit, and by and large, the Detroit police and fire pension system was reasonably well run. This hits your moral case of they played by the rules, they paid their contributions, there weren't any, you know, huge abuses going on. So there is this sort of moral case to pay them. On the other hand, the main Detroit pension system that went for most of their employees had significant problems. The employees didn't contribute to the plan. You had decades of bonus payments that were made out of the plan, that, you know, by some estimates that today would be worth up to $2 billion. Mm. Over time, the plan became underfunded, and then they said, well, let's just borrow to fill the gap. So you have, in that case, to be frank, I think that the moral case is weaker, because you had a plan that was controlled in many ways by the public employee unions who managed it irresponsibly. And then you have to say, where are we? This is not a strictly legal case of let's just cut everybody's benefits. You need context. On the other hand, though, I think the morality play of, you know, they played by the rules and they paid their contributions isn't exactly right with Detroit.
What about the moral question, Alicia Monell? You know, pay what you were promised. And to those who say, well, that was the hope, but times have changed. The economy is different now, and we have to adjust.
I agree with Andrew in terms of the different plans in Detroit, that police and fire did seem to be playing by the rules. The other plan did not. And in Illinois, what you have is you have the employees having paid their contribution throughout this entire period, and the employer, the state, not having put in the money. So when there's shenanigans, yeah, then there's reason and rationale for cuts. But when everybody's playing by the rules, then it's a harder sell.
You just published, Alicia, the ranking of U.S. cities in terms of pension costs. And Detroit, surprisingly, came in at 61. 61, a lot of people might suspect it might be a lot higher given these latest developments. Can you explain these rankings and what they mean?
There are two reasons. One, as John Day said, and as Andrew indicated, the police and fire plan has always been relatively well funded. And in the other case, there was a pension obligation bond, sort of money put into the plan several years ago. So pension costs in Detroit, or pension funding in Detroit, is actually better than for the nation as a whole. But they have a lot of other demands on their money other than pensions.
Let's get a caller in here. Sue is in Moline, Illinois. Hi, Sue. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. How are you, Jane?
Hi. Well, go ahead.
Yes, I'm a retired Illinois teacher, and I guess I'm a pragmatist because I'm relieved that there is some kind of a pension deal, because for the last few years as I watched the pension plan looking like it's going to go down the tubes, I was afraid I wouldn't have any pension. Mm. So I'm losing some of my cost of living raises, but it's better than not having a pension at all.
Mm. On the other hand,
yeah, I'm angry with the legislature for underfunding it all these years, but Illinois politics is like that.
So what would you like to see happen, Sue? You're right there in the middle of it. What's your answer?
Well, I think what I've read about what they've done so far is making the best of a really bad situation. So I'm just going to be hopeful that what they've done now has helped. And I hope somehow we can make them start funding it and not spending money on other things that don't need to be done.
Sue, thank you. Thank you very much, and good luck to you. Andrew Biggs, how much of a problem in all this is the sky-high pension, public pension fees? It's hundreds of millions of dollars that are paid out to hedge fund and private equity fund managers who are managing these pension funds. I mean, I'm looking at some of the numbers here. In New York City, $472 million in fees. That's up 28% this year alone. New York State pays $500 million in fees. That's up 54% over the last 5 years. I mean, some outrageous figures. What do you make of that, and how big of a problem is it?
My gut feeling is that the investment fees, you know, paid to Wall Street are essentially a red herring in this case, that the pensions are paying these fees because they think they're getting something out of it. They've shifted very heavily into so-called alternative investments, meaning private equity and hedge funds, where they think they're going to get higher returns than the stock market, but in exchange for that, you pay higher fees. I'm not sure whether those are the best investments for them to be in, and I personally think the fees are too high. I wouldn't pay it myself, but the pensions themselves have judged that this is worthwhile. In any case, in the larger scale of the underfunding that we're looking at in public pensions nationwide, I don't think the fees are really a major factor in it. We had a decline in pension investments because the stock market went down. We've had increases in pension costs, due to the aging of the populations, due to benefit enhancements that were passed in the late 1990s. I haven't quantified it, but I would be very surprised if the investment fees turned out to be a major factor here. In any case, it's something they could solve tomorrow. They could shift their money entirely to stock index funds like the S&P 500 and pay essentially zero fees. Mm. If it's a problem, it's an easily solvable problem. I wish this were the only problem we were facing.
Easily solved, Alicia Monette?
I agree with Andrew, actually. I think fees may be too high. I'm very nervous about this trend toward alternative investments. But when you're talking about Detroit and when you're talking about Illinois and when you're going to be talking about Chicago in a month or two, I think the fees are a very small part of it. The pensions in Detroit are not well-designed pensions. They provide benefits too early. You can get your benefits after 30 years, and that's just too early a retirement age. And the same is true of police and fire after 25 years. So they're poorly designed pensions. They have not been funded. In Illinois, the employees have paid, but the state has not paid. And another issue keeps coming up, and that is that some of these plans have Social Security and some don't.
Right.
And so when you were talking to the Illinois teachers, she does not have Social Security coverage. So when she is so gracious about giving up her cost of living adjustment, it means that she will have no cost of living adjustments. And police and fire in Detroit also don't have Social Security. So those who don't are really left with little when you start cutting.
Here's Michael in Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the program. Hello.
Hello, Jane. I'm a retiree and very observant of what's been going on. Frankly, I think we need a vast expansion of the pension system back into the private sector because no 401k can generate the kinds of returns and the kind of security that a pension can. In Massachusetts, we don't get Social Security. If they were to add that, it would cost the employer, in this case the state, 8 or 9% of payroll just to go ahead and add that. The pension system costs the employer about 4 or 5 or 6%. There have been failures way back when I first went to work for the state in 1970. Mm-hmm. It was being paid on a pay-as-you-go basis, and then the banks came in and said it's got to be funded ahead, which was a good idea. Mm. But the rules keep changing, and we could end up with a lot of folks who are going to be on welfare, going to be impoverished in their old age, and dependent on the state, just shifting the burden from one door to the other.
It's an interesting point, Michael. Thank you so much for the call. Alicia Monette, I mean, I'm curious, are public employee and pensions typically more generous than pensions in the private sector?
Typically they are. And Massachusetts actually has one of the stingiest plans in the entire country and a very minimal cost of living adjustment. So Massachusetts pension finances are well under control. But it's not as if the private sector should be held as a model. People now are relying on 401k plans. We know how much money people have in these 401k plans. Households approaching retirement have $120,000, and that's all. And they are not going to have the old-fashioned pension plan to supplement this. And people are going to be very disappointed when they find out how little $120,000 buys.
Andrew Biggs, is part of the problem here that employment in the private sector has been pretty rough in recent years and perhaps that public sector deal looks pretty good to a lot of people these days? I mean, there's a lot of pension envy out there.
Sure. I think you get a kind of a convergence of two issues. One is this sort of top-down, budgetary issue of cities and states having more trouble making their pension contributions, of those pension costs squeezing out other government services. You call this service insolvency, where a city might cut its police or firefighters in order to accommodate pension costs. But then from the bottom up, you get get individuals who are saying, you know, my taxes are going up or my services are being cut to provide pensions that I don't myself receive. And I think that the reason it's become a big issue is because you're getting it from both directions. And, you know, it's, I mean, Alicia and I have both written on this. I think the main point I'd make is there's a lot of differences from state to state in the generosity of the pay that employees reach.
Mm-hmm.
The work I've done, I think the conclusion I've come to is in the states in which you think public employees are probably overpaid, the ones you hear about in the news, they probably are overpaid. In the states you don't hear about, you know, Kansas or something, the state or Virginia or Indiana, those states, the numbers sort of indicate they're not. So it really varies quite a bit from state to state. But, you know, in my opinion, at least, there are some states where clearly you could reduce overall compensation without creating an uncompetitive pay package in the public sector.
And Alicia Monell, part of the debate here, before we can even think about solutions, is how we measure liability. I mean, you heard John Day, the retired Detroit detective. He doesn't trust the amount of liability Detroit is said to have. How do we measure pension liability in all this?
So this is this can send us off in a tangent, but basically what you have is the sponsor, the state or the locality, promising benefits way far into the future.
Right.
And then you have to restate them in terms of the present value. And you need some interest rate to bring those numbers back. And if you have a high interest rate, you get a low amount. If you have a low interest rate, you get a high amount. And so people are arguing about the interest rate. And the interest rate used by in the public sector now is too high by the view of any financial economist. But it's what they've been using. They are trying to bring it down. It's less bad if you look at it in real terms. But one thing, Jane, is that public employees generally are not rich guys. We can argue about if their compensation is a little too high or a little too low. But on average, and both Andrew and I have done work here, is that it's about the same in the public and private sector. So if you're really talking about cutting pensions a lot, we ought to also be having a conversation about what is the right level of wages to have in the public sector as well.
That's a critical component of this conversation, Andrew Biggs.
Oh, sure. No, I understand. I mean, it's the accounting issue here for pensions is very, very important. And it's something that has kind of been lost in these discussions recently of Illinois and Detroit, because the problems in those places is not that, you know, they have some mismatch of assets and liabilities 30 years from now. It's the problem they've got a cash squeeze today they have to reach. But for pensions in general, the accounting rules that the U.S. public pensions work from are much more lenient than the ones that apply to private sector pensions or that are used by public employee pensions in other countries. If you're in Canada or the UK or the Netherlands, they have much stricter accounting rules. The rules we have here essentially say the more risk you take with your investments, the higher this discount rate you can use to value your liabilities, and so you look better funded. Not surprisingly, public pensions in the U.S. take more risk than private pensions, or they take more risk than public pensions in other countries. So it's these accounting rules seem really arcane, but they're encouraging excessive risk-taking. And when you have a lot of risk in your pension investments, that means your contributions are going to fluctuate a lot more from year to year. It means a bigger chance you're not going to make your contributions when you need to do it.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about state and local pensions this hour, the pension burden, and what to do about it. Last week, speaking with NBC News' Donald Smith, a retired Detroit city worker with 29 years of service under his belt, said he is afraid that his $888 a month pension will be cut in the wake of Detroit's bankruptcy.
All I'm asking is that somebody give me what I earn. I'm not asking for a handout.
Alicia Monell is with us today, one of our guests, director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, and also with me, Andrew Biggs, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute studying Social Security and state and local pensions. He joins me from Klamath Falls, Oregon. I'd like to hear what each of you would say to this man, this retired Detroit city worker, 29 years of service under his belt. He says, all I'm asking is somebody give me what I earned. I'm not asking for a handout. Andrew Biggs, what do you say to him?
Well, it's a little bit hard. My guess is Detroit doesn't have as much transparency as some other pension systems. It's a little bit hard sometimes to tell who's getting what. But and my guess is the lower income folks who didn't really avail themselves of things as much. But you know, in addition to a defined benefit pension for which the Detroit employees, as far as I can tell, didn't pay anything. In addition to that, they had a defined contribution 401k style plan on which they received 8% guaranteed returns, and they received bonus payments in good time. So it's for somebody who's low on the income scale, I wouldn't do anything to them. For folks who are higher up, you had employees retiring in addition to their traditional pension with retirement accounts in the hundreds of thousands of dollars financed by benefits or by income that was sucked out of the traditional plan, which left it underfunded. So it's would I cut their benefits? Probably not. Can I say unequivocally that Detroit public employees deserve not to have their benefit cuts? I'm not so sure, because you really did have mismanagement there, and the public employees were the beneficiaries of that mismanagement.
So mismanagement aside, Alicia Monell, I mean, what about those who say, you know, people don't stay in jobs as long as they used to? The whole structure of pensions has to change. Times have changed. Pensions has to change with it.
I think we've learned a lot in this whole public pension event that happened in the wake of the financial crisis. And we've had two types of systems now. We have a public plan, old-fashioned pensions, where the employer bears the entire burden, all the risk. We've had the 401k system in the private sector, where the employee bears all the risk. And when the stock market tanks, the employee just takes it. The question is how to design a program so that risk is shared, that you sort of know what the risks are. They're explicitly defined. Mm-hmm, and if things go wrong, you have a plan of how it's going to be divided among the parties. And so if you look to Canada again, you see public systems being set up that have some explicit risk sharing. And in the private sector, I mean, these 401k plans just cannot be viewed as a success. So I don't think we want to go from one extreme to the other, but it's a right time to be thinking about how to design pensions sensibly.
Patrick is in Claremont, New Hampshire. Hi, Patrick. Glad you waited. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm just wondering how these people can they've made a deal, and they're not living up to what to their end of the deal. And now these people who worked their whole life are expecting this to happen, and now it's too late for them to say, hey, you know what? Maybe I wouldn't have done that if you didn't tell me that this great thing was going to happen when I retired. And, you know, I'm from the Detroit area, and I'm in another private union. In my union, is supposedly my pension is funded by the government, and if the government, the federal government, if the government can turn its back on these people who work for them, what's going to happen 30 years down the road when I want to retire? Are they going to tell me, sorry, you know, we don't have the money to do what we said we could do?
You're out of luck. All right, Patrick, thanks for the comments. I appreciate it. Here's another one from Nancy in Somerset, Kentucky. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank
Hi.
You.
Of course.
The U.S. government bailed out the banks, AIG, and so on, at the cost of over $1 trillion. These are people who should be in jail rather than being rewarded for the crimes that they committed. I feel the U.S. government should go in and bail out the pensioners. That the U.S. government has that obligation to save the cities, to save the states. Okay, that's it.
Okay, that's enough. Nancy, thank you. Alicia Monell, what about a U.S. government bailout of pensions?
Just personally speaking, I don't want to go into Illinois and give them any money. Illinois politicians haven't paid any of their bills for decades. And I'm sorry for Illinois public employees who have to take the brunt of this, but I don't think it's a reasonable way to go.
Andrew Biggs?
Well, I think this all raises some good points in terms of, you know, what do we do going forward? That we're in these terrible situations in Illinois and Detroit, and nobody has a good solution to it. But I think the idea is that Alicia presented a risk sharing in pensions. They have benefits, I think, over and above just the ones she pointed out. The problem for defined benefit pensions in the public sector is there's a million ways not to do the things you should do, not to make the contributions you should make, and you have politicians who don't want to do the right thing. So it's just an accident waiting to happen. When you get some risk sharing into the equation, though, you're aligning the interests of the workers with the health of the system. In a lot of cases, if we're going to pay these benefits regardless of what happens, if that's what we're saving to do in Detroit, there's no reason for the Detroit pensions not to do what they did, which is to pay out billions in bonus payments over time. But if you tell people, look, you're going to share in the risk. If we're underfunded, public employee contributions are going to rise. That's what happens in Nevada's pensions. That makes people a little more reticent to do some of this irresponsible stuff, and it also means that the public employee unions are going to put more pressure on the elected officials to make their payments when they have to make them.
Alicia Monell, some of the risk sharing, sharing responsibility for all this?
I think that that's the way we have to go, but we also need to set up some mechanism so we are absolutely sure that the politicians put in the money that needs to be put in so we don't get in this kind of situation again.
Here's Carol in Akron, Ohio. Hi, Carol. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Actually, my complaint is that, and of course, I'm learning something as I sit here and listen to you guys. I live in Ohio. I am retired from the state of Ohio.
Okay.
And the thought that they would take away my income is chilling. I worked a lifetime working for them, and in an endangered position.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I really feel that all of this bandying about in regards to, quote, a pension, my income is in the pension and not in my mind. When I went to work for the state of Ohio, I was not given a choice mm-hmm. as to whether or not I would pay into the public employment retirement system
mm-hmm.
or get Social Security. It was, you work for the state, you no longer pay Social Security.
There wasn't a choice. And now you're thinking you might be stuck with it. I hear it. Alicia Monell, would you respond?
So Ohio's really an interesting case because Ohio had problems. The unions got together with the politicians, got together with the employees, and they have cut their plans in an orderly, gentle way that will actually solve their problems.
So when we say we've never had cuts to pension funds, not the truth.
Not the truth. And it, more broadly than Ohio, in the wake of the financial crisis, you saw big increases in employee contributions. And of course, if the employee has to contribute more, it means the state is actually providing less. We've seen a lot of cases where the cost of living adjustments were suspended or eliminated. And then for new employees, there's been dramatic cuts going forward. And it takes a while for that to have an effect. But there's been a lot of cutting going on. So Detroit is not the first time that we have talked about cutting employee pensions.
Andrew Biggs, what about another potential solution of cutting new employee hires? What kind of effect might that have?
I mean, that's been the standard approach. I think, like, New York State is on their fifth tier of retirement benefits.
Yeah.
I tend to think that's actually a bad idea, but it's one that's based on the limitations of what they can do. If you cut benefits only for new hires, you make public service less attractive to those folks. You're lumping all of the pain on new hires, not on the current employees. It is also something that takes a long time to generate any savings. The public sector differs from the private sector. In the public sector, it is generally interpreted that once an employee is hired, you can't change the terms on which he is earning pension benefits. The question there isn't that, you know, can you default on what he's already earned? Can you alter the rate at which he earns benefits in the future? In the private sector, you can always do this. We need to have reforms in the public sector giving elected officials the right to change the rate at which you earn future benefits. That lets you spread the pain among the entire workforce, not just new hires. It also will give you some savings more quickly. And that's going to be a real big bone of contention out in California. The San Jose mayor is pushing the idea of letting elected officials do this, but it's meeting a lot of resistance. But I think that's a better approach than just sticking it to the new hires.
Sounds like Alicia Monell, that combined solutions are really required here. I mean, I'm looking at the numbers from many cities, but in New York City, they now pay more in public safety benefits than in wages and salaries.
That's totally possible. We do have a way to do what Andrew wants to do, which is even in those states like California where you can't explicitly change the benefit, when you make employees pay more, that's a way of cutting the benefits for current employees. And in the private sector, people's pensions are protected only to the extent that they've been earned to date. Private sector employers can cut pensions going forward. So I think that should really be the model in the public sector, too.
Let's go back to the phones. Tammy is in Freeport, Illinois. Hi, Tammy. Glad you called. You're on.
Hi, Jane. Hi. My husband worked in the private sector for 25-plus years and made good money, paid a lot into Social Security. Then he became a teacher. He knew at the time he was going to lose a significant amount of that Social Security. He did not, however, know Illinois was going to, you know, do what they did with his pension system. For people like him, what's that Social Security? Do they get any back that they lost for going into that public sector? I feel as if he paid into two systems and he was stolen money from both of them.
Tammy, thank you very much. Alisa, do you know?
He will definitely get his Social Security benefit. I think it's very hard to go back and put in the money that it was foregone. So I think that is not remendable.
Here's Brian in Frankfort, Kentucky. Hi, Brian. You're on. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Of course.
My comments deal with I'm a public employee myself, a state employee, and what concerns me is we've had right around 5 years of no COLAs. And when I say COLA, that is actually our only source of raises. We don't get bonuses. We don't get a lot of things in the private sector that I used to get when I worked there.
Okay.
And when we talk about limiting our pension, it's our pension is based on a rate of pay when we retire. Ours is a high 5 years, an average of a high five. And then they apply a factor. It's roughly around 50% of our pension. High five average. And it's it's been devastating already. And for new employees in Kentucky, they don't have a pension. And we're trying to hire people, and it's so hard to hire people because we really can't. We can't afford to offer them competitive benefits. Yet the public is under this belief that we're all getting six-figure salaries, and that's not true. I think when they look at the average, they look at the very low end, all the way down to maintenance people, all the way up to attorneys and software developers, and the average says, "Oh, well, the average is not."
It's not a fair average. Brian, I hear you, and the clock's against me here. Alicia Monell, would you respond?
I think two things. One, public sector employees are not rich people. These are not the highly paid. These are not the Wall Street people.
Right.
And that's the first point. And the second point is we want them to be paid a decent salary, and we want them to have a decent retirement once they stop working. I think the key thing here is when do you stop working? And I think in the public sector, the retirement ages are probably too early. They're sometimes in their 50s. They need to be in their 60s. But we want to treat these people with respect and give them decent compensation.
Andrew Biggs, with the federal court ruling this week with regard to pensions in Detroit specifically, will that make bankruptcy more attractive, a more attractive possibility for local governments across the country who are facing similar problems with their pension funds?
Well, I don't think bankruptcy is ever going to be an attractive option, but I think it may give cities that are on the edge a little bit more negotiating power in terms of reaching agreements on pensions. That I'm not sure that this Detroit ruling is going to be binding across the country, or even if it will be upheld on appeal, but I think it will give cities the power to say to the employees, let's cut a deal on this now because in bankruptcy, something could end up being worse. That may be a better outcome than a lot of cities declaring bankruptcy and dragging everybody through all this stuff.
Alicia Monell, look on the horizon for us. What do you see looking forward out there when it comes to pensions, pension crises across this country?
So I actually see most places muddling through. The public pensions as a group were fully funded in the year 2000 using a very high interest rate, albeit. They then were hit by two financial crises that dramatically eroded the asset side of the equation. The stock market is coming back. The sponsors are trying to put in the appropriate amount. And I think and they've cut cost of living adjustments. They've increased employee contributions. And I think in most cases, people are going to be able to muddle through. And that is good. At the same time, I think we probably want to design better systems so that everybody feels more secure going forward.
Andrew Biggs, I'll give you the last 30 seconds for the last word moving forward. What do you see?
Well, I think Alicia is right. In a sense, though, it'll be unfortunate if, say, a rising stock market tells people they don't need to reform these plans. The plans were 100% funded back in the year 2000, but because that's based on the assumptions of high returns and risky assets, they're also very economically vulnerable, as we saw. They need to get something which is more stable, more sustainable over time, but what we see is that only happens when they're under pressure. So I want them to fix their plans, but fix them through reform is not necessarily just through the luck of a good year in the stock market.
Andrew Biggs, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alicia Monell, director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College and also at their Carroll School of Management. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Important information today. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.